And as soon as the service is over, I'm exiting out that door to get away from her, you know, because she's not gonna. You know what's really cool about this morning, though, is that there are people sitting right here this week, you know, other than just like Pastor Paula and Jonathan, who's supposed to be watching, right? So we're going to check with him tomorrow. But that is so cool, because I got to be honest now, if you're new to the church, okay, for the past few months, so one of the air conditioning units went out, and so we were afraid during the summer it was going to get too hot, so we moved over to the chapel, and this is our first week back, because hopefully we don't need air conditioning anymore. And but I got to be honest with you, when we were here before, you know, I kind of thought that y'all didn't like me, because nobody would sit anywhere close to me, and it just kind of bothered me. Everybody was way out in here and stuff. And now look, you like me. This is so cool. You like me. Yeah, I love it. Because of ropes, though, isn't it? It's because of the ropes. They just, yeah, I get it. That's all right. But it's good to be with Pathways. I love you guys. And Paul asked me the other day how I was enjoying my experience with you guys, and I love it. You know, I really do. Praying for your pastoral search committee. You know, you know, for Christmas, we wish we'd had a senior pastor, but we may not be here by Christmas time. But we're praying for y'all. But I'm enjoying my time. That I'm able to be here with you guys. So thanks so much for putting up with me. So this morning, I'm going to begin with an ordination story, because, you know, in preacher school, they tell you always start your message with a bang, and everybody loves a good ordination story, isn't that right? You like ordination stories, right? What's your favorite ordination story? He's hating those ropes right now. He's really hating those ropes right now. So in a lot of denominations, like Methodist, Presbyterians, and stuff, it's the denomination that ordains a person. Baptists are different. Each Baptist church is independent. We don't let the denomination tell us anything. So every Baptist church, any Baptist church, can ordain whoever they want with whatever qualifications. Okay, so when I was a freshman at Baylor University, I knew some guys who were freshmen and sophomore who'd been ordained and were pastoring churches, and I'm looking at them going, dude, like 3 months ago I was a high school senior, I was dumb as a rock, you know, I mean, not that all, I mean, you know, I mean, I was, because here's the thing, I thought I knew everything. But I didn't know the one thing that I needed to know was that I didn't know nothing, you know. I thought I knew more than my parents did. So I'm just 3 months removed from that, and here are guys just like me, you know, as naive as me, and they're ordained, you know. I'm like, well, it must be Texas or something. I don't know that we do that here in Maryland or anything. But what would happen in a Baptist church is they would ask, and oftentimes these are rural churches, but there'd be a young guy, and he felt a call in ministry, so they called him to be their pastor. They might have 30 people in the church. They were glad to have a warm body up there preaching. And so what they would do is they would call an ordination council together. And this is usually pastors, other pastors from the area, and the ordained deacons and the ordained staff and stuff like that. And they'd come in a room, and they would form this ordination council, and they would ask questions. They would explore the candidate's call to ministry, ask him questions about theology and Bible and stuff like that. And usually these are softball kind of questions, you know what I mean? Because we're all friends here, nobody's out to get you or out there to prove anything. So a typical question would be, you know, describe for us your understanding of the Trinity, you know, which is, you know, one of the more difficult things, three in one and stuff. But you ought to be able to at least do that, you know. If a pastor asked you something like, describe the hypostatic union between Christ and his church and as it relates to modalism and the Arian controversy of the fourth century, we'd all look over at that guy and like be like, dude, did somebody kick your dog and steal your woman? What is wrong with you, you know? So there's this one ordination council. And the everybody had gotten kind of spent all their time asking questions when pretty much everybody thought that they were done. It was time to go, you know, eat supper or something like that. One old pastor said, hold on. I have two questions. And he looked at the candidate and he said, young man, do you love people? Have you ever heard the phrase, there's no such thing as a stupid question? That's not true. There are definitely stupid questions. You know what I mean? I've thought of a lot of stupid questions. I've said very few of them because, see, I've got this mental process, okay? A stupid question comes into my head from wherever questions come from, and my brain looks at the stupid questions and it says, well, that's a stupid question. And it will not send it to my mouth, okay? So then I won't ask the stupid question. But invariably, in the next 30 seconds, some dude asks the very same question that I had thought, well, that's a stupid question. And when I hear it comes out of his mouth, I'm like, yeah, that dude, that was a stupid question, you know. Did your brain not filter this out? Did the question just bypass your brain and come straight out your mouth, you know? So do you love people? What do you expect to say, right?
Well, no, I really don't love people, but I hear there's a lot of money and fringe benefits in being a pastor, so I thought I'd give this thing a try, you know. No, I don't like people. I just wish people would leave me alone. Everybody's trying to talk to me while I'm reading and stuff, you know. No, what kind of question is that? Do you love people?
But he said, I have two questions. And so, you know, when he asks such a, if not, it's not stupid, it's just simple, right? You know that there's going to be a follow-up question that's going to really get to the heart of the matter. Do you love people? And then he said, how do you know? How do you know? That right there is a great question. We all say we love people. But how do you really know? How do you really know? You know, that's a question that only an experienced pastor would ask. Young pastors go into the ministry wide-eyed and with an idealistic view of the church and of people, which is, and it's not only idealistic, it's unrealistic. I heard a pastor a few years ago, we were talking, he's telling me about some of the problems he was facing in his church, and he at one point he said, you know, I just kind of expected church people to act like Christians. And I said to him, well, dude, they do. I mean, look around. This is how Christians act. Isn't that right? This is how Christians act. It's not like we, you know, become a Christian and then all of a sudden we're poof. You know, we're great people and we have no flaws and no issues that we're working through. No. Well, the moment we become a Christian, we still bring with us all of our baggage, all of our faults, all of our dysfunctionalities. They don't just magically disappear when you become a Christian. We're all in the process of working our stuff out. And so naturally, when we come into a church, that stuff's going to come out, you know, and we're going to kind of inflict it on other people. So what he really meant was, I don't know, I kind of expect church members to act like Jesus. Well, that's a whole nother ball of wax, you know. I mean, that just exposes the unrealistic expectations we often have of each other. To act like Jesus, I mean, that's certainly the goal. How many of us have achieved anything close to that? We certainly aren't there yet. And here's the thing. If we just would read the New Testament, you know, we would see that most Christians don't act like Jesus. You know, read Paul's letters to the churches at Rome and Galatia and Ephesians and Ephesus and Philippi and Corinth, and we see that Christians, by definition, act like Christians, even though they don't necessarily act like Jesus. because the occasion for all of Paul's letters was some conflict that was going on in the church. You know, it's not like Paul just got up one day and said, I think I'll write to the church at Philippi. You know, no, there's something going on at Philippi that he's got to address. The same thing with Romans, that church at Rome and stuff like that. They were all suffering some form of dysfunction. And a lot of it was ethnic conflict. It's a good thing we got this dinner next week, you know, because we're addressing one of the main problems that is addressed in pretty much all of Paul's letters. They all suffered some form of ethnic conflict, Jew versus non-Jew, you know, but also class conflicts and gender conflicts and theological conflicts. But if you look closely at the theological conflicts, you'll see that the problem was that they had constructed a theology to support their prejudices rather than the other way around, to support their ethnic and class and gender prejudices instead of allowing a theology to judge those conflicts. But also understand this. The ethnic and class and gender prejudices they had didn't come from their theologies or their understanding of God. Their understanding of God was created to support their prejudices. And we still see that going on today. I want you to hear this also. The solution to the conflict isn't to act like there aren't any distinctions between people. I mean, that's just obvious that there are distinctions, you know. It's not it doesn't deny there's distinctions between the ethnicities or a difference between a rich person or a poor person or men or women or anything like that. It's clear men are different than women and rich people and poor people. Our experiences make our lives different. It's not the diversity that's a problem. It's thinking that one is better than the other. You know, that somehow men are elevated in God's eyes over women when it comes to leadership and ministry. It's thinking that rich is better than poor. You've heard the saying, I've been rich and I've been poor. It's better to be rich. My observation is that rich just brings a whole different set of poverties. That's not just monetary. So we're different. But we don't let those differences come between us. So we see all of this going on in the church at Corinth, with the added prejudice that there were some church members in Corinth who thought that they were better than everybody, better Christians, more spiritual Christians than everybody else, because they had spiritual gifts, you know. They could speak in tongues, and they could speak in prophecy. Nobody could understand what they were saying, so you kind of had to take their word for it, you know. And then where the rest of everybody is like, well, I don't do that. They're obviously more spiritual than I. And so there's this conflict that's breaking out between these people who think they're better than and act like everybody, and people who, well, maybe even bought what the other people were saying. So Paul has to remind them. He has to remind them that no matter who they are or what great things they may have done for God, if they don't love people, and not in the abstract, I mean if they don't love people, the people in their community, they're nothing. They're nothing. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but do not have love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And Paul's throwing it down right there at the very beginning, right? If I speak in the tongues of men or angels and have not love, I'm just a noisy gong and a clanging cymbal. He's saying, so, you know, some of you say you have special knowledge of mysterious spiritual things, or you're able to prophesy, or he says, you know, in 1 Corinthians 13, and he invokes the language of Jesus. He says, some of you have faith to move mountains, or you've sold everything and you've given it to the poor. Great, but guess what? If you don't love each other,
you ain't nothing. And I think it's fair to add, if you're a member of God's favorite religious group or favorite ethnic group or whatever, you know, if you've been blessed through hard work and God's favor to have material wealth or be born male in a patriarchal society, if you don't truly love people, that don't mean nothing. But how do you know? How do you know if you really love people? So in the rest of the chapter, Paul kind of gives an answer, okay? He shows us what this love, this agape love, truly looks like. And he describes it using 15 phrases. The first two are love is patient and love is kind. Love is patient and love is kind. They're kind of like the topic sentence for the rest of the chapter. Everything flows from these two. Real love is patient because real love knows that we're all working through our stuff, right? None of us have arrived. Every one of us has a long ways to go. So we understand that. We get that. So we're patient with one another. And kind. Real love is always filled with the kindnesses to love a person just as they are, right? And to be patient with one another, those little, you know, loving one another with those little acts of consideration that makes life bearable, that makes it pleasant, because life is hard enough and we don't need people in church making it harder on us, right? This love that Paul talks about is able to handle the fact that there are differences among people. There are differences in talents and abilities, some of which are seen and celebrated, while others are not seen. They're you know, behind the curtain, if you will, largely unnoticed. Love is patient. Love is kind. And he goes on, love is not envious or boastful or resentful or arrogant. In verse 5, he says, love is not rude. There's a big one. Right? Love is not rude. The King James Version says that love is not unseemly, which means not in accord with established standards of taste or proper form. I don't know. Given what now seems to be the standard for, you know, taste or proper form and people's discourse with one another, I'm going to stick with rude, you know, because we all know rude when we see it. Do you love people? How do you know? Instead of rude, the New International Version says, love does not dishonor people. And that's not a bad way of translating the Greek there. If you're intent on showing love to another person, you will find ways to honor that person. You don't treat them in a way that discounts their worth as a person. You don't dismiss their lived experience because it's different from your lived experience. You listen, and you're willing to open yourself up to the reality of their lived experience, because maybe that's the most honorable thing you can do, the most honor-giving thing that you can do, to listen carefully to their lived experience when it's different from yours. And then Paul says, love is not self-seeking. And I think that's what lies behind the ability to honor others. Not self-seeking, insisting on its own way. Love isn't always asking, what's in it for me? Because when you really love people, your learning is for their benefit. Your service is for their good. Your leadership is not self-aggrandizing, but is for their enrichment. Love is not self-seeking. And, you know, this is God's kind of love, right? So this doesn't come natural for us, because we are, by definition, we're self-seeking. That's how we're born, right? We are self-centered, and if we don't get our way, we're going to wah-wah-wah our way until we do, right? We are born self-seeking. So by nature, we're always wondering, how does it benefit me and what I want and what I think I need? But real love doesn't make
that the first question? And Paul showed the Corinthians that. One of the issues that the Corinthian church was dealing with was whether or not they should eat meat that had previously been offered to idols. And it was a big issue. It sounds weird to us, right? Because we know theologically that an idol is nothing. It's just, it's a piece of wood. It's a carving or a rock or something like that, you know. And so Paul says in Corinthians, he says, most of us know it's not a thing. We don't worry about it, right? Because meat sacrificed to an idol is just meat sacrificed to a nothing. There's nothing wrong with that meat. So we eat it. But he said that there are some who came from pagan backgrounds, and they still kind of retained some of these pagan beliefs. And so they were rocked to their core when they saw one of the Christians in the church that they loved and they respected, and they saw them eating this meat, and it made them question everything. And it bothered them. It bothered them when more experienced Christians acted like their concern was no big deal, that it was stupid even. So Paul, you read 1 Corinthians, he spends basically 3 chapters on this one issue. See? And the principle, he said, is that nobody should seek their own good but the good of others. That's the norm. So even when you know you're right, allow them to be where they are and love them in that moment. The basic question isn't, what's in it for me? It's how does my actions, my attitude affect the whole Christian community that I'm a part of? So love isn't rude or dishonoring of others. It's not self-seeking. And then Paul says it's not easily angered or irritable. Depending on your translation, it's not irritable. Well, depending on who you are, that can get you downright irritable, you know? Because Paul doesn't know the idiots you have to put up with. You know what I mean? Paul just doesn't understand, right? Paul, the guy who's imprisoned at least 2 times and given 39 lashes 5 times. That's 195 individual lashes if you're counting. He was beaten with rods 3 times on 3 separate occasions. He was stoned 1 time. Yeah, that guy has no idea the trouble that you've seen, right? Love is not irritable and love is not resentful. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Now, do you love people? And how do you know? Paul's given us some things to think about. But if we really want to get to the root of the subject, I suggest we go all the way back to the beginning. See, in Genesis 1:27, it says that God made humanity in his own image and likeness. Male and female, he made them. So in other words, there's no hierarchy between male and female, because that would imply some kind of hierarchy within God. And that can't be so. So humanity, on all the richness of its male and femaleness, is in the image and likeness of the Creator. But in Genesis 3, what is called the fall of humanity happens. That basic equality, not sameness, but equality, it's disrupted. And the female is subjected to the male. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. Now, this is not God's perfect design. It's not how he wants it. It's part of the curse of sin. And yet there are many Christians still today who are teaching, who believe that this is God's design, his original design for all of humanity. For men and women, husbands and wives. But furthermore, the sin that entered into the world in that one act of rebellion, we were taught, I was taught, It makes null and void everything that came before with regard to humanity, such that the fundamental identity of every human being that came after Adam and Eve is that of sinner. That's who you are. That's your fundamental identity. Not the made in the image and likeness of godness, but the sinnerness. So that when we're born sinners. That's what I was taught. I bet a lot of you were taught that as well. When we're born, the fundamental truth of who we are is sinner, not image bearer. That God's original creation is gone forever, and all that's left is to destroy this mortal coil until all that's left is a spiritual place filled with spiritual people. But that's not the biblical image. That's not the biblical story. God didn't create the world as plan A, and then we disrupted plan A, so now he's moved on to plan B. No, that's not how it works. No, the biblical image is of recreation, of restoration, of renewal, not just for the world, but for the people who inhabit the world. So understand this. Sin did not destroy the image of God in each person. That image has always remained. Sin might cast a shadow of it, but that image is always there waiting for light to rid it of the shadow. And let me suggest that how you view the basic humanity of a person determines how well you will love that person. If you are unable to see the image and likeness of each and every person, even in the midst of their sin, even when they're inflicting their sin on you, if you're unable to see the image and likeness of God in them, then you can't truly love them well. When you define people primarily by their sin, you can never truly love them for who they are. You can only love them for the potential of who they can be, even if that can be is in Christ. So I love you based upon what you might be, but not based upon who you are right now. And it seems that the greatest gift anybody can ever have in their life is someone who loves them just the way they are. And loves them so much that they accept the way that they are, even as they encourage them to be all that they can be. It sees both, right? The present and the future. But you got to start with loving them just as they are. Because that's the very definition of unconditional love. Isn't that right? And as I said before, if those of you who know anything about Greek or 1 Corinthians 13, you know that, you know, the Greek Bible uses different words for love, right? Storge and phileo and but the God love, agape love, the unconditional love, that's the word that Paul uses throughout 1 Corinthians 13. That unconditional love. And if you're able to look past a person's sin and still see a person made in the image and likeness of God, then you are able to truly love them fully and know that you are loving them fully. And if you can't do that, you're just a noisy gong. You know, when I first became a pastor many, many years ago, but I wasn't just out of high school, I will say that, all right? But when I first became a pastor, the issue with churches was how to reach more people and bring them into the church. And then about 10 years before the pandemic hit, things changed, and churches began to focus not so much on how we can get people into the church, But how we could keep them from leaving. How we could keep our young people from growing up in the church and then leaving the church and never coming back. And then post-pandemic, it's become even more acute, you know. How do we get people to come back to church? That's just a variation of the last question. How do we get people to stop leaving the church? If you look at churches all over, people have left and aren't coming back. And I've always said that people leave the church for three basic reasons. This is an oversimplification, okay? And there are a multitude of reasons, but you can kind of boil them down into three different reasons. I call them the three B's. Okay, they got bored, they got busy, or they got burned. Bored, busy, or burned. So we tried to make church less boring. And that's not a bad thing to do. I mean, it's good to not be boring, you know. I try to inject my messages with some humor and you know, some things that make you go, you know, try to keep you engaged. I don't want you to be bored, you know. So trying not to be boring, that's good. And so, you know, churches started doing what they could to make things less boring, you know, screens and drums and guitars and synthesizers and stuff like that. And we did that because we had to compete for busy people's time on Sunday mornings, because the church no longer had a monopoly on Sunday mornings, right? Used to have a monopoly on Sunday mornings. Nobody had anything else to do but come to church. So guitars and drums and synthesizers, you know, kind of added that cool effect to things that we thought might attract people to our churches to choose, you know, get them to choose church on Sunday morning. So that kind of took care of the bored and the busy kind of stuff. But the problem is that while some people might stay because of drums and guitars and synthesizers, there was a whole other set of people who would leave because of drums, guitars, and synthesizers. But if you didn't allow the drums and synthesizers and guitars into the church, and they only had hymns and organs and choral music and stuff, then you'd lose all the guitar, drums, and synthesizer people. So we began to fight about what kind of music we were going to have in church. I referenced this a few weeks ago, and kind of in passing. Called it worship wars, because that's what it was. They were wars. Even the wars were waged with smiles on our faces. They were still wars. You know what the sound of those wars was? Noisy gongs, clanging cymbals. Listen, people aren't going to come to church because it's boring are the same people who don't read because they think it's boring, right? Or don't exercise because they think it's boring, all right? And people who are too busy to come to church are the same ones that can't find the time to exercise or to learn a musical instrument or spend time with their kids. You aren't going to change them no matter what you do. But the last B, people who left church because they got burned, because they got hurt, because they saw ugliness in a place they didn't expect to see ugliness, because they came to church expecting to find a place of unconditional love, but what they found were people who couldn't find it in themselves to put aside their own interests for the sake of building an authentic community of Jesus followers, deserving of his name. So they stayed away. And you know what I say about them? Good for them. Good for them. They ought to stay away if this is how Christians are going to act. Do you want people to come to this church? And to come and to stay? Love each other. In such a way that follow-up question, do you love people? How do you know? it'll be evident. You'll know, and everybody will know. Be the kind of church that truly loves one another. And let me tell you something, folks. You be that kind of church, we won't need ropes to get people to sit close to each other. Love one another. I started with an ordination story, so let me finish with an ordination story. One pastor had been around the block a few times and had that vast storehouse of pastoral knowledge, said that he always asked only one question at an ordination council, one and only question. He would ask the candidate to get up and go to the window. He said, go to the window, and I want you to find some person walking down the street or whatever. He said, describe that person theologically. Describe that theologically. And he said that generally he found that the answers would come in one of two forms. Some would say, well, that person is a sinner who's loved by God, and because of their sin nature, stands under God's judgment. But God provided a means of removing their sin by sending Jesus to die on the cross for their sins. And if they believe and accept by faith Jesus' death, then they will be saved. It's correct, right? Perfectly sound theological answer. He said other people would say, that person is a person who is made in the image and likeness of God and is deeply loved by God. And he demonstrated that love by sending his only begotten son as a sacrifice, the redemption price paid to redeem them from their slavery to sin so that they can be restored to their proper place as a child of God. Both of those answers are theologically, doctrinally, biblically correct. But he said, in his experience, the ones who answered that last way always made the best ministers. Do you love people? How do you know? How do they know? Bow your heads with me in prayer, will you? Gracious God, we describe as the heart of your nature that you are love. God is love. And you live love in the Trinity, embodying the love of Christ. This love triangle of community and relationship. And you embody that love to us in Jesus Christ when he came and lived among us. And you empower us, you empower that love in us through the Holy Spirit. Lord, help us to know that love for ourselves, but not be satisfied with that. Because Christianity is much more than just knowing your love for ourselves. But as Paul says, to move beyond ourselves, to show that love to others. Even in the midst of stressful times, Lord, help us to offer peace and patience in the midst of our hurry and empathy in the midst of our exhaustion. Restore us, Lord, and help us to be agents of restoration and comfort to others. Because, Lord, you love us so, so wonderfully. So may we learn to reflect your love in all of our relationships. Give our time and attention and assistance freely, to treat others as we would want to be treated. Teach us to love. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. All right, family of God, let's stand up together, and the priest team has come to the front to lead us in worship through song once again. And if anybody wants to come and share anything that's going on in your lives, Paula and I will be down here at the front, or you can catch us after the service as well. any questions you have, any things you need to discuss, any decisions that you feel led to make. Let's sing together. Let's lift our voices together. We are the family of God, worshiping together in the house of God. Let's worship Him right now as we sing.